This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Masa kejadian banjir itu, mungkin dalam pukul 10.30 ataupun 11, saya ada di belakang rumah sedang buat motor, meripair motor saya sendiri. Lepas tu saya dapat satu panggilan daripada kawan, mengatakan air umpangan akan dibuka. Dia, bapak dia kerja TMB. Kira dalam masa yang sama saya ingat, oh ini mungkin dah tak berapa serius, macam biasa selalu tiap-tiap tahun. Yang kita orang pertama yang kena. Oh bangun banjir, tak boleh buat apa. Tengok kereta pun sudah pompang-pompang.
Good afternoon. This is Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, and I'm Juliet Jacobs. The merciless destruction of Cameron Highlands' natural resources has caused massive devastation to the environment and the people that live there. The Disappearing Hills is an interactive documentary that investigates the aftermath of the floods in Cameron Highlands, Malaysia, which happened back in October 2013. Filmmaker and photojournalist Yeo Kai Wen joins us to talk about this interactive documentary and how he went about capturing the stories of the victims of the massive devastation on the Highland. Hi Kai Wen, how are you today?
Hi, I'm good.
Thanks so much for joining us. I was reading your bio online and it says that you have bathed in arsenic contaminated water, travelled to the Arctic's edge and slept in Asia's largest slum, all in the name of telling stories. Can you tell me what got you interested in photojournalism?
It all began back then in 2009. It was a school trip that brought me to Cambodia. Mm-hmm. And we were tasked to actually document the lives of people affected by arsenic poisoning. Mm-hmm. So it was then that it really struck me that, you know, there's so many environmental problems that's going on, even in countries that are so near to Singapore. Mm-hmm. So decided then that, you know, I would really like to continue picking up stories about the environment. Mm-hmm. And that got me going.
So were you always interested in like taking photographs even as a young child, or was this something that, you know, just when you went to university you started?
I think I got started in secondary school. Interestingly, what got me started taking photographs was I used to be a dancer. I started taking pictures of people, you know, of our choreography and our dance moves and stuff. And that over time, you know, I picked up a proper camera, and then, and the rest was history.
So now would you consider yourself a professional photojournalist now? What is your day job currently?
I graduated last year after I completed the Disappearing Hills documentary. Mm-hmm. For NTU, which is Nanyang Technological University in Singapore. Mm-hmm. I did my degree in communication studies there, and right now I'm just a full-time freelancer.
Okay.
So I specialize in events, corporate, and also once in a while wedding.
Okay, mostly photography work and filmmaking as well a bit?
Yes, photography and videography.
Videography, okay. All right, so now we're discussing the Disappearing Hills today. Before we get into that, you know, what compelled you to head to Cameron Highlands in particular to sort of gather this story?
I think, first of all, because as I was doing my research on what topic to approach for the film, I realized that 98% of Singapore's vegetable consumption actually comes from Malaysia. Mm-hmm. And as a Singaporean, all we know is that we head to the supermarket and everything is there prepared for us. So the thing that came to mind was that, you know, what's the environmental impact of us importing so much vegetables? Mm-hmm. And that led me to do more research, and I came across what was happening in Cameron Highlands back then. From 2013 all the way to 2015, there were floods happening every year. So I asked myself, you know, what's happening over there? Yeah. And I decided that, you know, maybe I should head over to do a recce trip to speak to some of the locals to find out more.
Okay. And once you got there, you decided, I think you spent about 3 months in Cameron Highlands just to gather the material for your story?
Yes, I spent up to 3 to 4 months over there in Cameron Highlands to gather the stories.
Okay. And so when you went there, did you have any sort of preconceived notions? You know, did you have any kind of like an angle, let's say, that you wanted to pursue and you went straight for it? Or did you just go with an open mind and said, I'm going to go see what I can get and move on from there?
It was part of the letter, actually. I went there with an open mind because I didn't want to go with any particular slant.
Yeah.
So the cool thing was that on my first night there, I was just having my dinner. I was thinking, okay, where should I start? Such a big place. And it's so difficult to get around, you know, the highlands without a vehicle. I actually went there by bus.
Mm-hmm.
So the first night I was there, there was this lady who came out of the shop, and then she was waving a stack of flyers. She said, you know, hey, we are going to have a protest tomorrow. Would you like to join us? You know, and as a Singaporean, we don't really see protests very often. So I got excited, and I told myself, okay, that's it. I'm definitely going to go for this. And the next day, that was what happened.
Right.
And the people were actually protesting against all the illegal land clearing that was going on. And that was also where I met a lot of other contacts who offered me very warm hospitality.
Mm-hmm.
There was a lady who told me, you know, you're a student from NTU, you're here doing this documentary. Do you need a car? I have two cars. I can lend you one for the next 3 months.
Wow.
And then there was another lady. She's like, "Oh, I have a house. I have a room that I could loan out to you for 350 ringgit a month."
Amazing. Yeah. I guess people really wanted somebody to tell their story.
Yes. Everyone had a story to tell. Everyone was telling me that, "Hey, I know this person. Would you like to speak to him or her?" And you know, gathering the context was almost like a breeze over the next 3 to 4 days during my recce trip.
Right. So for those of us who've actually forgotten, could you give us a rundown of, you know, the Bretham Valley floods and what happened after? I mean, in your website, disappearinghills.com, you've broken it down very clearly into four different parts. Maybe we can walk through that to kind of discuss what happened. So part one, of course, is the floods. Could you just remind us what actually happened? It was back in October 2013, if I'm not mistaken.
Correct. So in October 13, what happened was the dam. It was a late evening, and everyone was more or less asleep. The dam overflowed. There was heavy rain, and the dam actually released quite a bit of water in Bertam Valley, and that caused quite a lot of flooding downstream. And the houses that were downstream were just built very close to the dam.
Mm-hmm.
So, and over the next one or two years, 2014, 2015. There were also floods happening, but not in Bertam Valley. But most of these floods were caused by illegal land clearing and also all the sedimentation that has been built up in the dam over time.
Did people perish in the 2013 floods?
If I remember correctly, I think there was one or two people who perished, and I think they were more or less like foreign workers.
Right.
So the locals were not that much affected, just that their houses, many houses had to be rebuilt.
Mm-hmm.
And everyone in Bertam Valley actually had quite a bit of damage done to their property.
And, you know, following that, those crazy floods, there was, of course, public uproar, and everybody was, you know, there was a lot of attention. So then the government, they created Obscudding, which was by the National Security Council, to get rid of the illegal farms in Cameron Highlands, which is, you know, how you framed your second part of the film. Could you tell us more about that?
So for Obscudding, the interesting part was that what we saw was soldiers holding M16 rifles, going rolling down the road with excavators, and they were cordoning off a section of illegal farm, and then they'll start tearing it down with bulldozers.
Mm-hmm.
So huge expanses of land were cleared by Obscudding, and the farmers were really upset because, you know, they've done this, they've been clearing this land without the official permit for years. So they've been actually clearing bit by bit over time, but nobody stopped them. But all of a sudden, because of the floods and, you know, all the hoo-ha, then this had to happen in order to...
So that somebody could look like action was being taken, right? After what happened.
Yes, correct.
But I suppose, but you did point out that they were illegal. These farmers were doing things illegally. So, I mean, well, the next part, of course, is of your film is The Invisible Farmers, or how you framed it anyway. So when you spoke to the farmers, I mean, obviously, they did do something illegal.
Okay, so what happened in Invisible Farmers, these were actually... these are not actually farmers. They are actually illegal workers who were in Cameron Highlands trying to earn a living.
Mm-hmm.
So they were working in the farm, many of whom were actually like Indonesians or Myanmar.
Bangladeshi, I think, a lot.
Bangladeshi. And in fact, most of them were Bangladeshi.
Mm-hmm.
And they were there trying to earn a living. So because of ops guarding, these people had to hide in the forest
right.
to avoid detection. And authorities were going all around with their dogs and their military, trying to catch these people and send them away.
Mm-hmm.
So that was also part of the story because, you know, at the end of the day, who are the ones who are tasked with clearing the land over time is these invisible farmers.
So when you said invisible farmers, you meant actually the workers who were working the farm, not quite the farm owners themselves.
Correct.
Okay. Part four is the Red Earth. What was that about?
Part four is actually what happened after Ops Gadding, and the farmers came together and they said, okay, we're going to do something to stop all this destruction, and they wanted to form an organization to do more responsible farming. So it's more like a happy ending kind of thing.
So a nice positive spin to the end then.
Yeah.
Joining me on the line from Singapore today is filmmaker and photojournalist Yeo Kai Wen, and we're discussing the documentary he made in response to the aftermath of the Bertam Valley floods, which happened almost 3 years ago. Coming up after the break, we find out more about the people he spoke to make the film and who they blame for the floods. You're listening to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
If there is no development in the rain there, I don't think it will be flood. The water will be absorbed into the ground, slowly into the soil, slowly into the river. But because of a lot of cutting of trees and whatnot, and because of the, what you call, of the shade, the water, that no trace where to go, straight into the drain. Even a mountain can be leveled. So this is where the very distinct things. You know? If you were tested just now, if you drive towards Sempang Pulai, you see a lot of those hills are bare now. You don't see any more trees. Green. It's all bare earth before they put up that what you call the shades. You know? That's the way I look at it. It becomes a pity, but you have done it.
Good afternoon. This is Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, and I'm Juliet Jacobs. Joining me on the line from Singapore is Yeo Kai Wen. He's a filmmaker and photojournalist who spent several months in the Cameron Highlands gathering footage for his film, The Disappearing Hills, which is about the flooding in Bertam Valley, which happened about 3 years ago. So when you spent the 3 months there to gather all the material for your story, I understand you went on all sorts of difficult terrains for your research, you know, because of course you had a lot of camera equipment. So what were some of the places that you went to gather all this information?
I did go in the jungle. That was crazy. It was raining, and then they were hiding in a hut. There were even babies in there. So
babies. So from as in the workers' babies.
The workers' babies were there too.
Yeah.
So because they are born in such a, you know, a place, it's quite sad actually to see what was happening. On the other hand, you know that they are not supposed to be here, so it was difficult trying to tell their story. And then, particularly because I didn't understand their language, so I had local contacts with me,
yeah.
And they helped to translate. I spoke to them in Chinese. They asked them in Malay, and then the Bangladeshis will reply in Bengali. So you see them crying over when I was interviewing them. I had no idea what they were saying. And then when I went back to Singapore, I sent the transcription over for a professional transcription, and then that was only when I realized that, oh, this was what was happening there.
Right. And do you know what happened to them after? Like, did they manage to find safe passage out, or were they captured by the police, for example?
Some of them were captured by police, mm-hmm. but most of them actually fled Cameron Highlands after Ops Gadding.
Okay.
Yeah, because they felt that it wasn't safe to work there anymore. And mm-hmm. you know how, do these people... the grass is always greener on the other side, so
yeah,
they are constantly fleeing different places.
Okay, so aside from the workers, you also spoke to many other different people. Who else did you, you know, approach for information?
I mean, I did try to approach authorities. I emailed them, but due to the nature of my project, I had very limited time and I didn't get a reply from them in time. Mm-hmm. So didn't get that. But other people whom I approached would be the farmers, those who cleared the land illegally. I wanted to hear from them why they did that and, you know, how did they feel about their farm, you know, being destroyed. So, yeah, that was also quite an emotional journey because quite a lot of them, they cleared huge expanses of land over, like, more than, like, 5 to 6 years. Mm-hmm. So it's not something that's done overnight where, you know, these people clear land.
Yep.
And at the end of the day, these are the same people who will be affected when the floods, you know, when the landslides happen.
Yeah. It's quite a vicious cycle, I suppose, yeah.
Yeah.
So you mentioned that everyone that you spoke to was playing the blame game. So who exactly were they blaming?
Okay, so the farmers would say that, it's something political. It's because, you know, we voted for the opposition. That's why, you know, this is what they decided to come and destroy our farms and stuff. Then, of course, they didn't understand that, you know, this had to be done in order to prevent future landslides and flooding.
Yep.
And, of course, the workers would be... the workers, actually, they were blaming themselves for coming here in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
They regretted coming and they felt that, you know, maybe they should have stayed where they were previously.
Right.
Flood victims were blaming TNB,
TNB
for releasing water on the night of the flood.
Right, because that's what actually made the dam break, right? Or that's what we think happened.
Correct. So people are pointing fingers everywhere and... But at the end of the day, what they didn't realize was actually that, you know, everyone had to work together to make things happen in order to prevent future disasters like that.
I guess it was a perfect storm of things, like, you know, so the authorities were to blame in some parts, you know, the farmers themselves were doing things illegally, you know, and uncontrolled. Everything just kind of made a perfect storm for what happened.
Yeah.
So, you know, from your investigations, who do you think should take the blame for this?
I think everyone has a part to say, regulations have to be put in place. So it's difficult to say exactly who is to blame because at the end of the day, I personally believe that everyone who lives there has a part to play when it comes to the flooding and the clearing of land. And when the government has to step in to put things in place, then it gets messy. And I feel that, you know, it's really sad when things like that have to happen.
Right. Let's just talk about the whole process of making the film. Like, how did you go about ensuring that you gave an accurate and impartial account of, I suppose it was chaotic when you went, you know? So how would you give an impartial account of the chaos there in, you know, both the film and also the photographs that you took?
So I drew up a superstructure after the recce trip.
Okay.
I told myself that, you know, okay, there's so many things happening in the highlands. How do I know which one, which people to speak to and everything?
Mm-hmm.
Of course, the local environmental group REACH, they were very helpful. They wanted me to, they gave me a lot of contacts and they also respected that, you know, I'm not doing an NGO film at the end of the day. I wanted to be as, to give equal coverage to each of the chapters.
Right.
So I made use of those contacts to find more context, and that was how I got a more balanced view. I made sure that, you know, I try to speak to as many people as possible. And the idea was to speak to as many people as possible first, and then after that, I will add that into the superstructure to see whether and balance it out from there. So there's quite a bit of planning and curation after speaking to these people.
And did you feel any sort of responsibility when putting all of this together? Like you know, responsibility to a greater good, for example. Did you feel any of that sort of thing?
Sorry, responsibility to what?
To anything, to the greater good. You know, did you feel some sort of responsibility to the people that you spoke to? Was there any sort of, if I can use the word burden of responsibility that you felt while trying to put everything that you got together into one small film?
Yes, there was quite a bit of burden. Everyone had a very different story to tell,
mm-hmm.
So I needed to pick up the best quote, you know, that really summarizes what was happening in each chapter. Yeah, and of course, in the case of the floods, it was most of the stories were more or less the same. Everyone was trying to get away. The recounting of what happened that night, everything just fell into place.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, like Operation Guarding and all that, those were a bit difficult to get access to because, you know, the military had cordoned off quite a bit of land and, you know, and access was really difficult.
Mm-hmm.
So sometimes it was a waiting game to wait for people, you know, to call me and say, hey, actually, you know, I know this person and you want to come and take a look. So, yeah, it was quite a bit of waiting as well in order to make sure everything was balanced.
Okay. And did you face any sort of ethical issues when you were filming, you know, putting the film together? Like, for example, for the foreign workers, do you feel like telling their stories was any sort of, how shall I put it, you were taking their grief and making a story out of it? Did you feel any sort of ethical issues about doing such a thing? Not that I'm saying you did, but just wondering if you had any sort of conundrums facing that.
Yes, okay. So, as a filmmaker, first of all, the most important thing is access and also relationships.
Mm-hmm.
So, the workers wanted their stories told on camera.
Mm-hmm.
They were looking forward to me coming, you know, to interview them because they were hoping that their message could get out as well to others out there,
mm-hmm.
so that they will not make the same mistake of coming to Cameron Highlands. Particularly because they were so keen on getting their stories told, I thought that, you know, it would be okay.
Right.
And as long as I did not jeopardize their position,
mm-hmm.
it would be okay. And also, because I knew that, you know, they were going to see the Highlands very soon as well because of flooding and all that. So, yeah, I don't think there was much of an ethical issue there. Yeah.
Right, and I suppose in that sense, you covered your bases. You made sure that nobody felt like they were being exploited.
Yes, correct.
Yeah.
So everyone who went on camera, they were very happy to be on camera.
Because mm-hmm. like you said, when you arrived there, everybody was just helping you out, trying to get context. I guess everyone just, like I said, wanted this story to be told.
Yes.
So have you done any follow-up projects since Disappearing Hills? Have you gone back to sort of, you know, see what's happening and do like a follow-up?
For me now, when I go back, it's more like as a friend.
Mm-hmm.
So I go back and visit the farmers. Not much the workers anymore because they are gone.
Right.
More of the farmers, actually. So I go back there and there's this farmer whom I've gotten really close to, and he calls me her godson. So they were really happy that I did the piece because they wanted their voices heard.
Right.
Yeah. So when we talk about follow up, it's more about just the verbal follow up, like, you know, hey, how are things now? And not much of any more filming that's taking place.
Yeah. And just from your observations, have you seen any sort of tangible change? Are things, you know, moving towards a better place?
The nice thing to note is that there were quite a bit of reforestation taking place after Op-Guarding.
Okay.
So, that being said, reforestation takes a long time.
Yeah.
A tree takes many years to grow. So, we can't be sure whether or not, you know, eventually things will get better.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, in terms of, like, for example, the government, they built dam widening project, which apparently would resolve any future flooding in Batang Valley.
Mm-hmm.
So it does look promising.
Okay.
So hopefully we'll see some change over the years. I won't say that there's a magic bullet for what happened in Cameron Highlands.
No, of course not.
It will definitely take years before we can see any form of improvement. In fact, other than the flooding issue, what I discovered was there's also a pesticide issue that's happening there, where there's overuse of pesticides and all the polluted water, contaminated water, is just flowing downstream.
That's
quite
horrifying.
Being used by other communities, and that's going to cause some long-term problems. Yeah,
which we can't even see just yet, right? It'll only kind of surface up a bit later when health issues.
Yes, correct.
Well, that's a scary thought. So anyway, your film will be screened at the Kuala Lumpur Eco Film Festival, which is happening from the 14th to the 16th of October. Can you just give us some information about when we can catch your film, and, you know, will you be there? Will you be doing any sort of talks in conjunction with the screening, etc.?
The screening itself, yes, I'll be there. The screening for KL Eco Film Fest, it takes place 14-16. So it takes place on the 15th of October.
Okay.
And I think for the Disappearing Hills, it'll be screened sometime at 10 p.m. It's a bit late, but yeah. So I'll be there if you guys have any questions. And I think the Eco Film Fest is a great opportunity for films like this to bring awareness about what's happening to our environment.
And, you know, I think the power of film is something else, because, you know, I do radio shows about environment issues. And I suppose when you actually see the devastation, that's when it really hits home. Well, I hope it does anyway.
Okay. Yes, it does. Especially when you see things from a wider perspective, you realize that actually a simple clearing of a piece of land can affect a lot of people downstream.
Mm-hmm. Uncontrolled clearing, you know, this yeah, unmonitored, correct. Yeah, that's the problem. What are some of your projects lined up for the coming months?
Right now, because there's quite a bit of work still ongoing for the Disappearing Hills, follow-up work, which is like more like, you know, preparing for the film festival and also taking up interviews. I've also been going around universities in Singapore to share the documentary. So I won't say that there's any upcoming work per se, because mm-hmm. There hasn't been a proper closure yet to the Disappearing Hills.
Okay. Yeah. So a lot more following up for Disappearing Hills then?
Yeah. Okay. More of like the sharing the film and trying to get people to understand what's happening there.
Okay. Yeah. So if somebody like wants to watch the film and they can't quite make it to the film festival, for example, where could we watch the documentary? Is it available online, for example?
Right now, it's still not available online because film festivals, they like to have exclusive
access to it.
Screening.
Yeah.
But you can visit my site, which is disappearinghills.com, mm-hmm. to find out more through the interactive documentary. And if you guys really want to watch the film, do try and make it down for the film festival.
Okay. All right. Thank you so much, Kaiwen.
Yeah, you're most welcome.
So the Disappearing Hills, if you'd like more information about it, you can visit disappearinghills.com. And if you'd like to catch it at the Kuala Lumpur Eco Film Festival, that's happening from the 14th to the 16th of October at Publica Solaris Dutamas. And the Disappearing Hills will be screened at 10 p.m. on the 15th of October. So thanks again, Kaiwen. You've been listening to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.